I would speak first a people's debt of gratitude to that band of modern pioneers who envisioned a great medical center here beside the East River. Behind the outlines of this fine medical science building, there emerges the architecture of their vision. Its stones are their plans, its mortar their perseverance. Its builders, knowing the paradox that life's satisfactions are more in striving than in succeeding, would say that they have built only a doorway, and that our obligation today is to look forward through it. There is substantial basis, I think, for the proposition that a veritable revolution is going on today in our thinking about our health, and that this revolution is of vital importance to the future of medical science and service. Not many years ago, the prevailing attitude, as it had been for centuries, was to accept illness and disease and premature death fatalistically. There seemed no choice but sad resignation. The struggle was that of two or three people sitting in a quiet room, trying with love and with prayer and little more than trained intuition to battle the unknown and to even a little the dreadful struggle. Often, too, there was unconscious association of sickness with shame, and certain ravages of the body were discussed only in whispers and camouflaged with euphemisms in the obituaries. Moreover, we faced the problem of our health, perhaps more than any other, virtually alone, as individuals, and hardly at all as a community. Yet today there have come almost suddenly unmistakable signs that we are ready to mobilize in this area our capacities to do by united effort, not necessarily through government, but together, what we have wanted but have been unable to do alone. This change comes in part, I think, as a consequence of the recent wide circulation of medical statistics. Figures tell so little of any story of human suffering, but these have been to many a shock treatment. One of every seven of us, as things are, will die of cancer. 10 million of us are today suffering from arthritis. 1 million permanently disabled. Sickness in the nation's workforce idles more employees than lack of work. And one of every 12 children born this year will at some time need institutional care because of mental disorder, unless new ways are found to combat the diseases of the mind. And these are only partial statistics. They say nothing of the grief and the suffering and the loneliness, which are their true dimension, to say nothing of the appalling public as well as private expense of disease. Yet if we have been shocked by such figures of tragedy and of waste into an almost frantic desire to do something, it is another equally startling report that gives us the courage to know that there is something that can be done. We hear, hardly daring to believe, yet knowing it is true, the story of the astonishing results during an 8-year period of new medical research and education. Deaths from influenza were reduced between 1944 and 52 by 3/4. Those from appendicitis and acute rheumatic fever dropped 2/3. Fatalities from syphilis, kidney disease, pneumonia, and tuberculosis were cut in half. In the past decade alone, the nation's death rate has been reduced by over 9%. The average life expectancy increased by 5 full years. And now there comes, as we all know, this spring, almost as from heaven, this great new strength against the dread disease which seemed to hurt us most because it struck with greatest viciousness at our children. And I am happy like you, to have this opportunity to pay my respects to Dr. Salk, whom we honor here today. I had not thought to enter the vaccine controversy, but if anything were predictable in our uncertain world, it was the immense and imperative demand for anything which promised to check the dread scourge of polio. I don't think it required any special clairvoyance to anticipate the demand for this vaccine, nor the supply and the hazards of production and distribution, or to foresee, with the happiness and lives of all of our children involved, that here was a situation above all others that called for foresight and meticulous planning and preparation. But to return to the spectacular achievements of this past decade, I am afraid you doctors will have to accept the inevitability that we are never again going to be satisfied. It's a grim irony that your profession can never do more than postpone ultimate defeat. Yet the central fact remains that people are now awakened to a willingness and a great enthusiastic desire to contribute fully toward this accomplishment. How? What form is this help to take? What is there for us, the people, to contribute to this essentially technical job? Money? Yes, of course. But more than that, too. It is vitally important that there be a people's program for their own health, so that they may marshal the support which is needed, may indicate the broad outlines of the non-scientific aspects of a democratic health policy, and may be at least able to make fullest use of scientific advance in this field. This is not the occasion for even an attempt at formulation of such a policy, yet there are several points on which a relatively clear agreement seems to be emerging. One is that methods must be worked out for making medical services better available to all who need them, and without crippling costs to anyone. We are spending more than $10 billion a year for medical expenses. We are willing, if we have to pay more, but we want to make this expenditure as effective as possible to realize the economy of preventive medicine, to assure the distribution of medical service on a basis of need for it, and to remove the haunting fear in so many American homes that if serious sickness strikes, it will wipe out every cent of savings, perhaps cut off all earning power, and destroy life's dignity, even if life itself be spared. We are appalled by the report that over 250,000 people die each year whom we have the knowledge and the skills to save. We think it's not right that 1 million American families will have to spend over half of their income this year for medical care, that there will be 500,000 cases of catastrophic accident or illness which will consume the entire family income, that 8 million American families are today in debt for medical care, that 2 million of these had to borrow at high interest rates to cover the cost of medical treatment. In too many American homes, a parent at some time or other has to look down upon a sick child who knows that something should be done and knows, too, that there isn't the money to do it. There is emerging impressive evidence of agreement that the most promising approach to this problem of distribution of medical service lies in the development of voluntary, private, prepayment health insurance programs. Indeed, 3 out of every 5 people in this country are now enrolled in some program of this type, although in very few cases is the coverage comprehensive, and so far only a small percentage of total medical costs are taken care of this way. Now, this principle of private health insurance seems ideally fitted to the necessities of the problem of distributing medical service. Prepayment encourages resort to preventive medicine, with resultant reduction in the amount of costly hospitalization. In their most effective form, these plans bring the ministrations of specialists to families who could not otherwise afford them. A purpose so admirably recognized and served incidentally by the work of the New York University faculty members at Hunterdon Medical Center in Flemington, New Jersey. These prepayment plans level out the peaks of unpredictable cost of major illness. They bring more service to more people on more reasonable terms. It's an important element in this development that it represents a private, non-governmental answer to a problem requiring group action. And these private prepayment plans are America's better answer to the similar needs that have resulted elsewhere in the state taking over this function. They represent a resourceful application of the American principle of mutual self-help to meet a big problem without substituting state for individual responsibility. But the application of this new principle is still an experimental stage. Certain barriers to its development must be broken down, particularly objections and even discrimination against forward-looking doctors. In half of the states, I am told there are restrictive laws passed in haste which prevent responsible private groups of doctors and patients from working out the effective prepayment plans that they consider best. And it's recognized, fortunately, by the leaders of both political parties that some degree of government assistance in developing this new program is necessary. The current proposal to meet this situation by offering federal reinsurance to voluntary health plans has already been rejected on all sides as at best a gesture. Reducing the uncertainties of insurers' risks may help a little, but it doesn't really approach the central problems of raising the money to get these programs started and then covering into them the low-income and older people who are most in need of more medical service. Much nearer the mark, I think, are those other proposals to make long-term low-interest loans to new prepayment groups and to subsidize part of the cost of comprehensive service to groups which include those whose financial means are limited but whose medical needs are no less great. The situation is, then, that a sound new principle for improved distribution of medical service has been approved by a substantial majority of Americans, and that the ways and means to implement it are at hand. This represents actually a great experiment in private, neighborly meeting of the ever-enlarging problems which are so characteristic of our expanding society. It is very important that there be understanding and cooperation between the medical profession and the community generally, for our health is, after all, everybody's business. And it is imperative that discussion not be frustrated by the familiar shouts of socialism that seem to bedevil all forward steps in this country. Another point of what is now very... general public agreement is that we need a good many more doctors and dentists and nurses and a substantially larger medical plan, more hospitals, and more or larger medical schools. There were, we are told, fewer medical graduates in 1950 than in 1905. And there are fewer doctors today in proportion to the population than there were 100 years ago. Small wonder that we are also told that we need at least 25,000 more doctors. On this occasion, it seems appropriate to press only one aspect of this problem. But this new medical science building and the developments to follow add appreciably to the nation's facilities for medical education. But still, this remains the obstacle to enlargement of the medical profession. New medical school construction, which will cost $250 million, is needed. And there is the further formidable problem that it costs four times as much to educate a medical student as he can be reasonably expected to pay in tuition. We gratefully, I believe, applaud the fact that private funds have made possible this building that we dedicate here today. But it gets progressively and painfully clear that private philanthropy cannot alone meet the doctor shortage, which is already upon us. Where the stakes are literally life itself, it would seem proper to use democracy's emergency methods. The United States Senate expressed unmistakably the national will when in 1949 it passed unanimously a bill to assist medical schools. The American Medical Association opposed that bill, and it died in a committee of the House. The expressed concern was about federal domination. But research in these schools has been subsidized by many millions of dollars of federal grants without a hint or a whisper of domination. And for my part, I don't believe that government has any desire or intention to dominate medical education. And I think most of us have complete confidence in the profession's development of an educational program. We are ready to do almost anything we are asked in order to get the doctors we need. The stakes, I repeat, are people's lives. And I hope it isn't dangerous heresy for a people's government to take an interest in people's lives. Now, the need for more hospitals. It may be said that more is being done on this front than on any other. But the need remains. And the cost of hospital care is so high that it is a constant anxiety in many American homes. But there is at least awareness of the proportions of this need. And we have had for some years an active and an expanding program of public and private participation for trying to meet it. Finally, there is a powerful, emergent demand today for an acceleration of medical research. The incredible achievements of barely a generation, the sulfa drugs, penicillin, streptomycin, and many others, the polio serum, whose author you honor today, are eloquent evidence of what's to come in research. And here again, in spite of all that has been accomplished, we are shocked by the uncompromising figures that with 10 million American men and women suffering heart disease, we are spending, what, $16 million a year on research in this field, or $1.60 for each person presently afflicted. That with cancer marking one of every seven of us for its victim, we are spending this year to solve that cruel mystery only $25 million or 15 cents apiece. That with mental illness costing incalculable suffering and almost $1.5 billion a year, we are spending $11 million, less than 1% of that cost, to combat it. That we are investing this year about a penny a person for research on arthritis and rheumatic diseases, cripplers of 10 million Americans. It seems a little strange, I think. You'll agree that the Department of Agriculture will spend this year for research on plant and animal diseases $10 million more than the Public Health Service is spending for research on cancer, arthritis, mental illness, neurological and heart diseases combined. This just doesn't make sense. And I don't for a moment mean to discount the value of corned beef and cabbage or ham and eggs. Yet the National Advisory Council's recommendations last year for a federal medical research budget for five key programs were cut in half before it went to the Congress. And I would speak out, too, against the policy of cutting off grants for private research where there is no conceivable security consideration, just because a question is raised by rumor or report. Unproven, untried report about the health researcher's loyalty. What sickness, what awful timidity is this that is now permitted to stop even inquiry into the secrets of biology and of man's physical survival? Nor does the argument that we can't afford to spend more on medical research seem very persuasive when 576,000 men and women are unable to work because of arthritis and rheumatism, who collectively mean a loss to the federal government of about $300 million a year in income taxes alone. Likewise, $2 million a year on research into the causes of blindness doesn't seem very large when tax losses from exemptions to the blind amount to 180 times that amount every year. One could go on and on, to demonstrate that good health is good business and that few public investments pay off like medical research. But it's not to increase the national income that we seek to stop needless pain and death. It is not in terms of dollars, but in terms of humanity, that the case for medical research is to be made. And we want to be led toward health, even as toward prosperity and peace. We have answered willingly and often leadership's call for crash programs to build better instruments of death. And now we ask humbly for leadership from the profession and from the government for programs to build better instruments of life. We seek together as a people freedom, including the freedom to live. I've tried to suggest what seems to me the tremendously important fact that there is emerging today substantial accord about important points in the nation's health program. We want to work together here, as we have in other areas of the common welfare, with the least possible reliance on government. We want to experiment with new ways to make medical science available to all who need it, encouraging its preventive use, spreading the impact of its cost so that in no home will the tragedy of serious illness be compounded by economic disaster. And we want to press fast now toward the beckoning horizons of hope already revealed by medical research. We seek also to enlarge our medical staff and facilities. It is from these common aspirations that this new medical center will draw its basic strength and in their furtherance find fulfillment of its broadest promise. Thus will it become not only a house of healing, a center of scientific progress, but more than that, a place of democratic achievement where professional skill is blended with a people's hopes to make a better life. Here, too, there will be served the still broader cause of the brotherhood of man. For healing, like music, is a bridge between races and nations. The secrets of life-giving, unlike those of death-dealing, can be made humanity's possession, binding the giver and the receiver ever closer together. Thank you.